It's going to be a good show today. Barbara Slavin is going to be here to talk about the latest on the Iran nuclear deal. Tyler Cullis will be on to talk about the sanctions and how easy and or difficult it will be for Obama to lift the sanctions for America's end of the deal, if there's to be a final deal. And we're going to wrap up, well, I don't know. No, I guess this will be the second to last interview with Gareth Porter about his book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, because, well, there's a big last chapter there on the fake war threat from Benjamin Netanyahu. But then there's an epilogue and all kind of current day sort of stuff to catch up on, too, as we're in between nuclear deals right now. Just the interim deal there. So we'll have Gareth back on today and then once more this week, probably, and hopefully wrap up that interview series with him. Join up the chat room, scotthorton.org/chat. All right, now let me see here. I got to copy and paste a couple of things. Well, just one thing. I feel like a real heel or something because I interviewed the great Robert Blumen from the Ludwig von Mises Institute Saturday before last. You know, the 2 days ago Saturday? No, the other one. A week ago, 2 days ago. And it took me forever to find the time to finally sit down and edit the damn interview. I did it this morning. Took me way too long, too, because I was distracted doing so many other things at the same time. And then I was going to play the interview for you on the show today, but then, no, I got 3 Iran interviews today. So tomorrow you'll get to hear the Robert Blumen interview. You may have already heard Tom Woods interview him. It was a great interview. I heard it, too. The subject matter is Say's Law and the Permanent Recession. It's really good. I mean, not that my end of it is really good, but Robert Blumen, he's really smart and said a lot of smart stuff. So I'll be playing that for you tomorrow or as soon as possible. I mean, I don't know. I guess something could happen and I'll be full of live interviews tomorrow too, but I'm going to try to get him on for you as soon as I can. He's a good friend of the show, Robert Blumen, has been for a long time. So I'll be happy to play that interview for you as soon as I can get him on. Just so you know. All right, now, I've only got 2 segments on my own today before we get to the interviews, so I gotta talk fast to complain about all the things that I want to cover on the show today. First of all, I think it's an important thing for people to read the Moon of Alabama blog. And that's from a song, I forget who, I don't know. But anyway, well, there's this old blogger named Billmont, who I guess is like a Democrat type, but seems really good on what's really going on in some foreign countries kind of stuff. Always was like that. Now, his blog is gone, but then he reemerged. It's been gone for years now. I don't know if anybody ever figured out who Billmont was. I don't know if it matters. Maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe he's just Billmont, the blogger. Well, anyway, he's not a blogger anymore. Now he's a Twitterer. But the Moon of Alabama blog is actually, these guys are the refugees from Bill Mond's old comment section. Maybe this is a little bit too much information for you. But, well, I got a point, which is I follow Bill Mond on Twitter. And, man, that guy's really on it. Whoever he is, or she, I don't know. Could be a woman named Bill Mond. What do I know? Just great. Really on point. And then also, the guys over at the Moon of Alabama blog, man, they're really good on this deep state stuff. They on great many far and wide subject type matters too, Syria and Ukraine, especially lately. Now, here's what's hilarious, okay, is as the guys at the Moon of Alabama blog and as Billmont on Twitter have been pointing out, there's a new conspiracy theory going around. I like to call it a bipartisan centrist conspiracy theory, since the bipartisan centrists always like to call every conspiracy theory either a left-wing conspiracy theory or a right-wing conspiracy theory or a libertarian conspiracy theory. Yeah, well, this is a moderate, centrist, bipartisan conspiracy theory, and it's completely stupid. And the theory is that all the neo-Nazis in Western Ukraine, why, they all really work for Vladimir Putin. and he's sent them there just to discredit the pro-Western, or at least the backed by the Western factions. And what's hilarious is how hilariously stupid this is. And here, Bilmon got in a fight with Strobe Talbot, who, as a commenter rightly points out here, is Bill Clinton's former roommate and is the guy that wrote the, I always want to call it the Birth of the Global Nation. That's not what it's called, is it? Anyway, he's a big one-world commie type, this Strobe Talbot. I forgot. He wrote this thing in Time magazine about how soon we'll have a one-world government and all nation states will be answerable to it, etc., etc. That's not twisting it out of context. That's what he wrote. But anyway, so he's a Bill Clintonite, basically, at the Brookings Institution. And he's saying, oh, yeah, you know, some of these thugs are funded by Russia for sure. And and the guys at Moon of Alabama write, now, after over 70 years of cooperation between the U.S. government and Eastern European fascists to further U.S. imperial goals, Washington, D.C. insiders believe those are Russian tools. These folks certainly smoke some rather strong stuff. Yeah, their own nonsense more than anything. But by the way, that 70 years of cooperation, that's a link. That's a hot link to this article in The Nation and at Foreign Policy and Focus, and it's rerunning at antiwar.com today. And it's this interview of a guy who wrote a book. Let's see, it's at antiwar.com. The guy's name is Refresh. The guy's name is Russ Belant, B-E-L-L-A-N-T. And he's interviewed at The Nation and at Foreign Policy and Focus and here at antiwar.com by Paul H. Rosenberg. 70 years of working with Ukrainian Nazis. And, you know, I'm not certain if it's the same old stay-behind program kind of thing. It sounds like it. I'm not sure if it all relates exactly back to the same chain of command and whatever, so don't quote me on that. But basically, it's just like in the rest of Europe where America, you know, tried to back right-wing radicals. In the event of a war with Russia, they would be ready to fight already behind the lines and that kind of thing. And of course, the most famous of the Gladio program divisions, you know, was in Italy with the promotion of the fascists and all their bombings that they blamed on commies and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, so, yeah, apparently this is the same kind of relationship, if not exactly the same relationship. Could be the exact relationship. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying I don't know. But it sure looks like the same type of relationship here with these Banderists, as they're called, these neo-Nazis. And, boy, read this thing at The Nation, man. Actual Nazis. Real Nazis that worked for the Waffen-SS, which was an international, as he points out in here, it was an international thing. They, you know, the SS went and created so-called local, I guess, you know, national SS divisions wherever they went, and the Ukrainian SS divisions got Holocaust work done for the Nazis during World War II. For real. They didn't just fight the communists on the battlefield. They participated in roundups and murders of civilians on, you know, not the grandest of scales compared to that whole war, but pretty bad stuff. And you know, some of these guys, you know, became Republicans. They came, the guy's book, Russ Belant's book is Old Nazis, The New Right and the Republican Party. It came out in 1991. And he talks about how some of these pro-Nazi or actual Nazis, leftover Nazis, were actually working in the Republican Party. And it was a scandal in Bush's 1998 presidential campaign. And they had to, nine of them, two of them from the Ukraine, had to withdraw from Bush Sr.'s campaign. Did you know about that? The book is Old Nazis, The New Right, and the Republican Party. There's an interview with this guy in at antiwar.com today. And now the conspiracy theory is that these guys who just put America's guys in power in Kiev work for Putin? Please. On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research, Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. NatSummit.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org.
All right. I'm Scott Horton. This is the show. And that's enough on Ukraine for today. Man, did you see this thing where Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, who this is really the best they can do in the Republicans. This is the establishment's pick. And they're so disappointed because everything just seems to come crashing down around this guy. He's such a buffoon. And they really wanted him to be their centrist establishment Republican business candidate for president there next time around. And did you get a load of what his latest gaffe was? He's in Las Vegas. Chris Christie, governor of New Jersey, Republican establishment favorite. He's in at least Nevada. I think it was in Las Vegas. And he's given a talk to Sheldon Adelson's group. Sheldon Adelson, the billionaire pro-Likudnik, who made all his zillions of dollars in gambling and bankroll Newt Gingrich and then Mitt Romney, as well as Benjamin Netanyahu in their last campaigns. And anyway, so he's given a talk to them, and this is so funny to me, I just can't get over it. Well, I don't know, it's kind of stupid, but anyway, he says, you know, I was over in Israel, Chris Christie says, I was over in Israel, and I took a ride in a helicopter over the occupied territories, and I saw from there what a military threat that Palestine, occupied Palestine, is to Israel, and poor little Israel, blah, blah, blah. So here, all he's saying is, oh, yeah, whatever completely ridiculous lie you guys are pushing as your narrative, I'm willing to sell it. Yes, the poor, demilitarized, occupied foreign helots that have been under permanent occupation under the martial law of a foreign power since 1967. Yes, they are a military threat to the country and the military force of the country that is occupying them. What a joke. How anybody could say that with a straight face, knowing they're being recorded or could be or anything, I just can't get over it. Really? But then, that's not it. You know what got him in trouble, right? Did you already pick up on it? He called the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and I guess the Gaza Strip, the occupied territories. And according to Politico, ooh, a hush went over the crowd and murmurs. Ooh, he called the occupied territories the occupied territories. In other words, you're really supposed to just pretend that no Palestinians exist. They don't live there. Judea and Samaria, there in the West Bank, why, that's just a land without people. Waiting for the people without a land. You know, Jews from Russia and New York City to come and move there and occupy and colonize the place. Like it says in the Bible or blah, 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 whatever. Oh, what a terrible faux pas for the governor of New Jersey to admit that there are actually people who live on the West Bank and in East Jerusalem. Less and less of them all the time as the Israelis bulldoze all their homes and build gigantic walls separating them from their property, from their villages, from their families, from their farmland, from their water. But still, you're not even allowed to call them the occupied territories, right? It's sort of the same thing as during the Iraq War, right? It's not an occupation. It's a liberation, man. We're just there to train them up. And when they stand up, we'll stand down. And all, yeah, yeah. What occupation? Just because, you know, armed foreigners are roving around in their streets and kicking in their doors and killing them. And, you know, sometimes electrocuting them. Suffocating them to death. And, you know, whatever. Shooting them. Blowing up their cars. What occupation? I don't see an occupation around here. And so then get this. Chris Christie had to go on bended knee back to Sheldon Adelson's private office and beg forgiveness. You think I'm making this up, man. Go look at the Politico. He wasn't criticizing Israel. He wasn't saying, man, those poor Palestinians. When I went up in the helicopter and I saw their poor, pathetic lives occupied by the Israelis ever since 1967, and I thought, geez, what a pathetic, horrifying existence. Maybe the Israeli military threat to their poor, pathetic civilian lives should be curtailed somehow by America. Oh, no. Oh, nothing like that. Oh, nothing like, oh, man, I kind of regret and resent that the Palestinians know good and well that it's American M-16s and F-16s that are holding them hostage forever. I wonder if this has anything to do with why our towers got knocked down back in 2001. Anybody? He didn't say that. What he said was, I was up in a helicopter looking at the occupation of the West Bank by the Israelis, and I thought, poor little helpless Israelis! When will the Palestinian occupation of their West Bank ever end? And then somebody in the crowd said, oh my God, he said occupation. Yeah, guess what? You know that your policy's wrong if you can't even describe it in English. If you have to lie outright in just telling people what you're looking at before the argument even begins. There was a war in 67, and the Israelis conquered the West Bank, and they haven't withdrawn since. But, you know, they didn't force march all the Cherokee to Oklahoma either. They're all still there. They're just slaves. That's all. But anyway, no, don't acknowledge that actually there are people who live there at all. There is no occupation. It's just Judea and Samaria. It belongs to Israel. It always will. Greater Israel. As Benjamin Netanyahu likes to call it. All right, anyway, I spent too much time on that, but I just think it's absolutely hilarious. Oh, and one more thing. So, about the Republicans. They're really upset about Rand Paul. They don't know what to do. Because Chris Christie is such a pathetic buffoon that he keeps blowing himself up every time he takes a step, closing down bridges and all of these horrible things. People died in that, apparently. I don't know. But they're scared to death of Rand Paul for the same reason so many Paul bots love him, because his name is Paul. And the same reason that people love him no matter how horrible he is on very important things like war and peace. That's the same reason the establishment will never trust him and will never believe in him. And they're so terrified of him that they're now trying to bring Jeb Bush out of retirement. After all, it was always supposed to be him, right? They ran Jeb and Junior in Florida and Texas in 1994 to make sure that they would have an incumbent Bush in the year 2000. That's why they threw the election in 96 and nominated Bob Dole. The Republicans did, because they wanted to have a Bush in the year 2000, and they ended up with Junior because Jeb lost his first run for governor. He had to run twice. Junior won on the first try. So by 2000, he was an incumbent and ready to go. So he became the president instead of Jeb. But he was always the loser of the family that everyone hates, including his father, including all of us. And so Jeb, you know, and he blew it worse than Jeb could have ever. I mean, come on, man. Anyway, but so now that's all they got. That's all they've got in the Republican Party. Because they're so scared of Rand Paul, they're willing to go ahead and turn back to Jeb Bush. But then, so here's the lesson to Rand Paul. That even though he's bad on Iran sanctions, and even though he's bad on staying in Afghanistan, and even though he's bad on Guantanamo Bay, and he's bad on accountability for torturers, and he's only good on protecting American citizens on American soil from being drone-striked to death by the military or the CIA. On the other hand, he's not so concerned if the FBI or the local sheriff's department uses a drone to kill somebody if they're in the middle of robbing a store, after all. He said that in his original filibuster and since. Right? So even though he's bad on all these things, like, oh, no, I reserve the right for the FBI to kill people with drones, you know, if they want to, they still don't love him anyway. In other words, he could be Ron Paul up there. He could be pure up there. He could be good on Iran sanctions and fight about it. He could be 100% good on domestic drones and fight about it. He could be good on Guantanamo Bay and good on getting the hell out of Afghanistan and win. I mean, he would be right to take all those positions, wouldn't he? And then even if he didn't win on the votes, he would win morally. He would win in the news cycle. Sorry to repeat myself, but the one time everybody loved him the most was when they thought he was being a purist on the drone issue anyway. There was Rand Paul being principled, being courageous, reminding people of his father. And that was what got them excited. Stand with Rand and all of that stuff. Well, he could have been good on around sanctions and the Iran nuclear deal this whole time. He could be good on getting out of Korea. He could be good on everything. And they wouldn't hate him and fear him any less than they do right now. And by the way, Jeb Bush is a joke. You know, Greg Palast has written about this in the past, about what a National Department of Education monger Jeb Bush is. And you know why, right? It's because he is a welfare queen in a Cadillac. That's why. It's because he sells this big plastic purple cow for way too much money that supposedly teaches kids how to read, but doesn't, or math, or whatever stupid thing it is. It doesn't do any of that, though, but it makes him money. And he uses the National Department of Education to force people to buy his big, stupid purple cow, so that then he can go on vacation on your dime. That's all Jeb Bush is a whore, except not a decent person like most whores. He's the bad kind of whore, a politician. He's horrible. And so his whole thing is Common Core and defending Common Core. Now, how the hell are you going to win a Republican primary like that? You know what? Rand Paul might just have a shot. If all Rand Paul has to do is say, Jeb Bush, Common Core. Jeb Bush, Common Core. This guy is a Ted Kennedy Republican, just like his commie rat brother, George W., and his Trotskyite set. If you want some more of that. Oh, look at all the stuff I didn't get to talk about on the show today. Oh, well. Good interviews on Iran coming up. Just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all his stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state. Available at scotthorton.org/Amazon. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and our first guest on the show today is Barbara Slavin. She's at the Atlantic Council and writes for, I think still Al Monitor, and here she is at Al Jazeera today. Obama administration confidant lays out possible Iran nuclear deal. Welcome back to the show, Barbara. How are you doing? Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. Are we live or taping?
We're live.
Okay.
All right. So, by the way, did I get that right, that you write for Al Monitor?
That's right. I still write for Al Monitor.
Okay, good. Yeah, I thought so. But I
wrote a story today for Al Jazeera America. I also write for them as well sometimes.
Right. Okay, good deal. And, hey, quite a story here. So this was, I guess, this morning. You went to the Brookings Institution, and they unveiled what seems like what's fair to call a trial balloon, final nuclear deal with the Iranians, or the shape of what that would look like, huh?
Well, actually, I got a copy of the report in advance, so I didn't go to Brookings this morning, but I read the report very carefully and wrote a story about my impressions of it. The author, of course, is a very influential gentleman, Robert Einhorn, who was working with the Obama administration up until about a year ago on the negotiations with Iran, and he's very close to people still in the administration. He worked for the Clinton administration as well, and knows people like Wendy Sherman, our chief negotiator, from that period, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good deal. And then, boy, I can't even read my notes. They're too small. I guess one of the first points that you kind of to set up the story, you talk about how important the internal politics are in America and in Iran. It's not just the negotiators have to keep in mind all these kind of extraneous issues in the minds of the politicians back in Tehran and back in D.C., and that has really kind of limited the range of their options in their negotiations. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't call them extraneous issues. I mean, if a deal is going to work, it's going to have the support of certainly the elite foreign policy circles in both countries, as well as the general public. It has to be something that both sides can portray as win-win. So, you know, Einhorn, I see this proposal as a trial balloon. Mm-hmm. It's put up to see what the Iranian reaction will be, but also what the reaction will be in the U.S. Congress and, you know, the reaction in Israel, other places.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that was what my note that I couldn't decipher was about. Your impression was that Mr. Einhorn must have shown this to the administration and sort of got their wink to go ahead and publish it as this trial balloon. That's your understanding, correct?
Sure, sure.
That sounds important.
That had to have been the case.
Right, okay.
Even though the State Department won't confirm it.
Okay, and then so now you talk in the article about ISIS, the Institute for David Albright, and then working
and international
on the
security.
Science and international security, exactly. And they've been working out all the theories of how long it would take to break out under these or those conditions, how many centrifuges they have up and running or available to run at any given time. And do I understand it right that you're saying that Albright's position now, or his understanding now, is that they could break out in about 2 or 3 months. They could have some weapons-grade uranium ready to make a bomb out of, but that what they think would be an acceptable deal would be to leave them with a nuclear weapons capability that would take at least 6 months to a year before they would be able to put together a nuclear weapon if they broke out and tried. And that would be about what the American side would be willing to settle for. Do I understand that correctly?
Well, you know, look, there are various permutations and combinations. The creation of this agreement has been compared to solving a Rubik's Cube. So, you know, if you have X number of centrifuges of a certain quality and X amount of low-enriched uranium or medium-enriched uranium, it takes X amount of time to produce enough high-enriched uranium for a weapon if you were to break out. By breakout means leave the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, kick out the inspectors, and go, you know, as rapidly as possible toward trying to produce that amount of material. All of these things are really theoretical scenarios. Of course, the Iranians say they're not interested in building nuclear weapons. But if you're going to have a deal, you have to assume the worst case and protect against it. That's what the American and European and other negotiators are doing. Mm-hmm. So David Albright works with a guy at the University of Virginia named Houston Wood, and they put out these breakout estimates for various permutations and combinations of centrifuges, and everyone pretty much relies on it. I wrote a piece for Al Monitor last month called "The Gatekeepers," and these are the people who put out these analyses and who will give the seal of approval or not to whatever comes out of the negotiations with the Iranians. Mm-hmm. And now Einhorn has, on top of that, come out with some other ideas, some of which are quite sensible, I think, and some of which may be a little controversial.
Yeah, well, I want to ask you about those in a second, but as far as the breakout times there and the ISIS calculations, I wonder, did they explain in there what they mean by undetected? Because I guess my understanding has always been that Well, like it says in the IAEA reports, no matter what else they're complaining about, they still always say that the non-diversion of declared nuclear material continues to be verified by the IAEA. So I never really saw where they had the ability to divert uranium to any sort of breakout without going ahead like the North Koreans, withdrawing from the treaty, kicking the inspectors out, and beating their chest and declaring that was what they were doing.
Exactly. That's what, you know, Albright means by these breakout estimates. If Iran were to stop cooperating with the IAEA, you know, which is, of course, what they have been doing, at least as far as we know, this is, you know, how long it would take them. There is also, I mean, some people think that if Iran were ever to try to, you know, build a nuclear weapon, they wouldn't use facilities that have been declared to the IAEA, that they would have some covert facility somewhere. But the Iranians have not been particularly successful at hiding their program. All of their facilities that they, you know, originally didn't declare to the IAEA, all of them have been discovered. Natanz, Arak, Fordo, all of these have been discovered. So I think, you know, we have a pretty good understanding of their program, and it would be difficult for them to do anything major that we wouldn't find out about.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, well, speaking of Fordo, I want to ask you about Fordo, but first we ought to quit burying the lead here. It seems like one of the most important parts of this, as you talk about again, it's Obama administration confidant lays out possible Iran nuclear deal by Barbara Slavin at America.AlJazeera.com. And you talk about how, I just hate the sound of this, that there ought to be a preemptive authorization to use military force as part of this deal, that Obama should go to the Congress and get them to pass an AUMF just in case Iran ever gets the idea they want to break this deal, that we can go ahead and attack them. That sounds like maybe a little bit too much, maybe almost even could amount to sabotage, if not deliberately. That might be too much to get in a deal, right?
I think it's a bone thrown to the Iran hawks, you know, and there are some on Capitol Hill. I think it's a way to deflect domestic criticism that Obama doesn't have the guts to confront Iran if it really were to break out and try to build a nuclear weapon. I'm uncomfortable with it myself. I don't think that the Iranian nuclear program merits the use of military force. I don't think that would be a solution to anything. But I can understand why Einhorn put that in there. As I said, it's a kind of way to cover the administration's flanks against criticism that Obama is somehow an appeaser and too soft and afraid to use military force, that kind of thing. Right. The Iranians, of course, would object. But, you know, there'll be other elements. And Einhorn, he talks about the elements of the nuclear side of stuff, but he doesn't deal with the sanctions part. And, right, of course, the unraveling of the sanctions, there's going to have to be a roadmap for that as well, that Congress will have to, buy off on. And that will be the carrot that would entice Iran, if anything will. Also, the fact that under this proposal, Iran basically gets to keep all its nuclear facilities. It has to modify them in such a way as to make them less proliferation prone. But it gets to keep all the buildings that it has built. And that's a big concession to Iran, the fact that it would be able to continue to enrich uranium at a low level. That's a big concession to Iran as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad they're finally getting around to negotiating that, because that's sort of been implicit ever since Obama took power. In the very first fuel swap negotiations, it was at least sort of implicit there that you can go ahead and enrich as long as you keep it to 3.6% for the electricity reactors. But it's the 20% makes us nervous, because you start counting a little higher there on the
That's absolutely right. So this is in the spirit of those original concessions.
Mm. All right. And now on Fordo, that's the secondary facility they built there. They're supposed to turn that into kind of a research sort of facility, right?
Yeah, and no longer be enriching uranium there. That's the facility that's built into the side of a mountain that would be very hard to destroy in a military strike, and so it makes a lot of people, particularly the Israelis, uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. So the idea is they can keep it, but turn it into an R&D facility for testing more advanced centrifuges and doing other nuclear research.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, too, that you say here that one of the conditions could be converting the Arak, A-R-A-K, facility to a light water reactor. It's currently not one, but I guess it's not up and running yet. But when it is, it could be producing weapons-grade plutonium. But I guess, is it that easy to convert it to be a light water reactor from what it is now?
It's not easy. That's one proposal. Another proposal is that if you use enriched uranium as the fuel instead of natural uranium, it actually lowers the amount of plutonium that could come out of it. You could also reduce the power level of the reactor, and that would reduce the amount of plutonium that would come out. And, of course, Iran doesn't have a reprocessing facility. So, I mean, technically, even if it, you know, went ahead with the heavy water reactor, it couldn't separate out the plutonium. But another way to just provide confidence, you know, that Iran will never build a reprocessing plant, will never get the plutonium, is to make sure that this facility doesn't have that much of it in the spent fuel.
Mm-hmm. And then can you talk a little bit to wrap up here about what's been implemented so far under the interim deal and whether all things are looking positive from here?
Yeah, I mean, so far so good. The Iranians stopped producing 20% uranium. They're converting their stockpile. They'll have none of it left in a form that would be easy to further enrich. In a couple more months, that stockpile will be all in a powder form or will be diluted down to under 5%. They stopped major work at Arak, A-R-A-K. They've provided more access to the International Atomic Energy Agency. Basically, they're complying, and they're getting some sanctions relief in return.
All right, good times. And then they meet again April 7th through 9th, correct?
That's right, on the political director's level, but the technical people are talking essentially every day. Uh-huh. So there's a lot of work that's being done. I don't know if they'll meet the deadline, but they're working hard.
Uh-huh. And then the big guys are supposed to meet again, what, in early summer?
The big guys are meeting April 7th, the bigger guys.
Oh, okay, good. Okay, well, thank you so much, Barbara. I sure appreciate it.
Sure, my pleasure.
Okay, everybody, that's Barbara Slavin. She's right here at America.AlJazeera.com. Obama administration confidant lays out possible Iran nuclear deal. We'll be right back. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. offnow.org. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. All right, so Barbara had to go, but that's all right. I think we got the news. Pretty big news there. Again, more Iran interviews coming up. Tyler Cullis and Gareth Porter will be on the show. All right, now, you may have seen the headlines this morning. They're talking about it on CNN International about how North Korea and South Korea, a.k.a. the DPRK and the ROK, were exchanging artillery fire today at sea. I saw some footage that looked really fake. Maybe it was file footage of a war game that they went ahead and threw up there for what was supposedly going on. They wouldn't have released footage of what had happened at sea anyway, even if they were filming it. I don't know what the hell that was supposed to be. CNN is retarded. Whatever, man. Anyway. You know what my point is. It's all America's fault. The Cold War's been over for 25 years. And instead of doing you know, the right thing, the obvious thing, making peace, a final peace deal, even with the bloody red commie North Korea, instead of this, you realize, everybody knows, right, that it's just a ceasefire. There is no actual peace deal to even end the war of the early 1950s. It's still a ceasefire. We still got 30,000 troops on the demilitarized zone. Is it the 37th or the 36th parallel or whatever it is there dividing the north and the south? Or is, oh, it's the 38th, right? The Yalu River was the other. Yeah, 38th parallel there. And anyway, so what's the holdup? They reunified Germany. They let Czechoslovakia split in two. They let the post-Cold War world shake itself out, right? And yet, not in Korea. And where, you know, Bill Clinton sent Warren Christopher over there, and he made a pretty damn good deal with the North Koreans, really, to at least keep them from making nuclear bombs. And then George W. Bush blew it up. And then he sat there, and they got nukes. I mean, what was he supposed to do about it? Nothing. Oh, didn't think that far ahead, huh? Well, we'll just sabotage the deal, and then we'll worry about what happens later. Nice going, guys. So now they've got a dozen or so nuclear bombs, although apparently they can't make them work very well, according to the results of the three tests they've held so far. They seem to be fizzles, although we don't have real complete knowledge of what happened at their tests. But anyway, you know, I don't know every little thing about Korea. Don't have to. I don't know every little thing about all of America's diplomacy with North Korea either. What I do know is if George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton and George W. Bush and Barack Obama had a policy that we want to solve this and we want a permanent peace deal and we want reunification and we want to do whatever we got to do to make China feel good about it and to make Japan feel good about it and to make the South feel good about it and make the North feel good about it, and let's figure this damn thing out. If they had that attitude, we'd have peace. We wouldn't have this at all. We wouldn't have the threat of a horrible war continuing to loom over the future of you know, at least that peninsula. Of course, it could drag in China, just like it did before. It could drag in Japan. I guess by necessity, if there was a war between North and South, it would draw in the United States. It's guaranteed. That's why our soldiers are there. They're hostages. Why our government puts them there and leaves them there, I'll never really understand, other than they would like to have a war. Or maybe they've convinced themselves somehow that the presence of our soldiers is what's keeping the peace there. But of course, the South Korean military is capable of keeping the North out. Maybe they're not capable of conquering the North, but they're even then, they probably are, actually. They don't really need us there, our guys there at all, other than if they want to have a small war, the presence of our guys makes sure that it'll escalate. And, you know, I know that most people don't think about Korea very much. You don't have much cause to, except for, you know, once every spring, the dictator of North Korea beats his chest and says some scary thing, and then he goes back to shutting up again for another year and whatever, like the Groundhog Day kind of a deal. And otherwise, can't get people really to pay attention to it. But to me, it seems, well, because of what a danger it is, and because how obvious the counterfactual is, I think this is really bad, man. I think this goes down to, you know, future history, looking back at how the Americans handled the post-Cold War world, and this is just horrible. When it would really take the slightest of effort to get this thing worked out. I mean, not the slightest of effort, but a real effort could make it work. You know? Anyway, pisses me off to think that, well, you know, I don't know. Fast forward to the future when a real war breaks out and tens or hundreds of thousands of people die in it, and it could have been solved all this time. What a waste, you know? That's my thing. And speaking of a waste, where's this headline about? Yeah, legislators. Mexican legislators asked why Mexicans should have to die over the war on pot when America's legalizing pot, at least under wink-wink medical circumstances. Even in Alabama, the reddest state of all, they voted unanimously. Did you hear this? Unanimous in both houses of their state legislature. I don't know if their governor signed it yet or what, but unanimous vote in their state legislatures to go ahead and legalize medical pot. They've outright legalized it, which is just unheard of, unbelievable legacy of the Western states referendum system that, you know, Eastern states can't have that. I didn't think I'd see it before I was in my 60s or 70s or something, man, that you would have a state outright legalize pot for pot smoking purposes, you know? Are you serious? And now the Mexicans are saying, yeah, well, as many as 80,000 of our people have died in the latest incarnation of their militarized drug war at the USA's insistence. Think it might be all right to call it off now? This guy Calderon, he must be a Democrat or something. Here's what he understands of economics. He became president of Mexico, and then he called out the military and had them actually go to war against the cartels, which, of course, just meant the cartels had that much more incentive to corrupt the entire government of Mexico, that much more incentive to arm up to military levels of violent capability themselves, and to severely punish anyone who was compromising whatsoever with the government with the most horrible of atrocities, cutting people's heads off and all this crazy stuff. Boy, is there a blackout on the Mexican drug war on TV in America, because how could they deny that it's all America's fault, the USA's fault? Everybody knows that. There's no government of Mexico. It is a satellite of the American empire. And their entire drug war is because America says so. Simple as that, and everybody knows that. So they just don't even, or sometimes they'll mention to you, oh yeah, 80,000 people have died. Eh, don't worry about it. It's not like it probably hurt when they were tortured to death or whatever. Out of sight, out of mind. You don't speak Spanish. Don't care. Don't worry. Big deal. And why? So you can send the right message to the kids that they shouldn't smoke weed? Well, you see, Timmy, we have to torture and murder and behead people so that you won't get the wrong message that it's okay to, you know, giggle for an afternoon. Because it would not be okay for you to do that. So anyway, we're going to go back to torturing and murdering people and killing people by the tens of thousands, unending, so that Republican wives can feel better about whether little Timmy may or may not ever smoke weed, which may or may not lead him to, you know, I don't know, overdosing on aspirin or whatever it is they're afraid of. So, you know, it'd be nice, some Mexican politicians here are at least working on it. This piece is at the Huffington Post. Legislators ask why Mexicans should die over a drug the U.S. is legalizing. Good question. There's no good answer other than they shouldn't have to die. It's the same thing, too, with cocaine and everything else. I'm tired of all this, well, maybe just pot, but not the others. What, are you kidding me? Oh, yeah, no, economics don't count in the cocaine business, only in the pot business. Oh, really, huh? Okay. If you say so. In fact, the more dangerous the drug, the more important it is that you legalize it right now. That way people, can go and seek treatment without having to fear legal criminal accountability for having a medical problem. Maybe a personal responsibility problem, but still. It's not criminal to have a personal responsibility problem. I don't know. It seems like people would snap out of it now. It seems like everybody has snapped out of it now. Am I right? Do we have consensus now? Everybody in America except the cops wants to go ahead and legalize drugs. It's just the cops because, you know, they're job holders, as H.L. Mencken called them. Tax parasites. Big, fat, stinking losers who are good for nothing. Who could not compete in a free market. They would have to be on food stamps and welfare and beg on the side of the road because they're pathetic. And they don't want to have to risk competing in an open labor market. They want to cash government checks for a living. like the tax parasite welfare whores that they are. And so that's why they want the drug war. But and you can see why, you know, the cartel leaders want to keep the drug war, keep them prices high. But who else is dumb enough anymore? Even the Republican wives know better now. They don't want their kid to get shot in this violence. Legalize it. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, that's it. From now on, anybody says optics or calculus, I'm banishing you from the face of the planet Earth. Unless you're talking about a lens or a math problem. God, is that the most obnoxious thing in the whole wide world or what? Yes, it is. Optics. You mean how it's gonna look? How it's gonna look? You sound so fancy when you say optics. We're all really impressed. But seriously, no, stop it. Please. I'm begging you. Okay, maybe that is just me, sorry. All right, our next guest on the show today is Tyler Cullis. He's with the Council, the National Iranian American Council, of course, NIAC. That's NIACouncil.org. And he's co-authored this thing with Trita Parsi here. It ran at Common Dreams under the name Will U.S. Sanctions Scuttle a Nuclear Deal with Iran? But it was published all over the place, too. Just search for Parsi, Cullis, and Sanctions, and you'll find it there. Welcome to the show. Tyler, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us on the show today, and sorry for making you put up with that on hold there. So, very interesting piece that you got here. Great analysis of the situation as it stands here between nuclear deals with Iran as we're implementing the interim deal and preparing to negotiate the final deal. And it's the question of these crippling sanctions, the layers and layers of sanctions that have been put on the Iranians by the U.S. and the U.N. Security Council and our allies, et cetera, et cetera. And as Barbara Slavin was just saying, how might those be wound down and undone? And it seems like what you're saying is they've passed so many sanctions and they've been implemented in such a way that it may be really difficult, even if Obama can make a deal with the Iranians that satisfies our executive branch's position, et cetera, that he may not be able to promise them the sanctions relief that he would have to be able to promise them in order to get them to make the concessions that he wants or that they're even willing to give if he could lift the sanctions.
Yeah, I mean, that is correct. I mean, under the Joint Plan of Action, the U.S. is committed to lift all nuclear-related sanctions under a final deal. We at NIAC asked the question, what constraints have been imposed on the president in being able to lift the sanctions unilaterally without needing Congress's approval. These are layers and layers of sanctions. The idea that Congress will revisit these issue every 6 months to lift sanctions in the phased approach that both Iran and the United States have agreed to do is just not going to happen. The president needs to be delegated the authority to lift sanctions on a permanent basis alone. The way the sanctions, I mean, it almost looks like a design flaw. It looks like a situation in which Congress simply failed to provide the president the requisite authorities to lift sanctions if and when a deal is reached. Mm-hmm. But if you paid attention to the legislation, from 96 all the way up to 2012, 2013, this was intended. In 1996, the Iran Sanctions Act was first passed. Under that legislation, the president was granted waiver powers for 12-month periods. That was revisited in later legislation where it was diminished to 6-month waiver periods. This is a critical discrepancy that I don't think people are entirely conscious of, which is that the president has broad authorities to waive sanctions on a time-limited basis for six 4-month, 6-month, 8-month, 12-month periods, but he has very limited authorities to terminate the sanctions completely. He would need to certify things to Congress that go far beyond the province of a nuclear deal, things related to ballistic missiles, things related to state sponsorship of terrorism, things related to security interests of U.S. allies. And this was designed intentionally to make it very difficult for the president to unilaterally lift sanctions without needing to go to Congress first.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, a couple of things there. Is there any chance that, first of all, I guess, is there any chance that the Iranians might be willing to say, like, listen, we understand the position that you're in. At least, you know, make sure that you can lift the ones that are directly related to the nuclear program. And once we got that out of the way, we ought to be able to work on the rest of this stuff anyway. So how about that, you know? You think, I mean, do they have the room politically to make that kind of compromise? Because, as you're saying, there's a lot of other sanctions besides just the ones that are in the name of the nuclear program.
Yeah, I mean, presumably the U.S. negotiators have communicated to the Iranians just what limits are placed upon them, right. Just what they can do themselves, and what will need congressional authorization. And presumably the Iranians understand that it will be politically difficult, especially in the next few years, for Congress to take the kind of action that a deal may require. Nonetheless, there's two problems with this. One is during negotiations. What the U.S. what the executive has to offer is limited, limited reversible sanctions. And it does not allow the White House to fully leverage sanctions relief for concessions on Iran's nuclear program. So what you may end up with a situation in which Iran's negotiators look across the table at the Americans and say, if you're presenting us limited reversible sanctions relief, well, we're going to match that limited reversible sanctions relief with limited reversible nuclear concessions of our own. So it raises problems on coming to the terms for a final deal as well.
Right.
Now, if a deal is reached, it presents problems after a deal is reached. The U.S. is obligated to meet its own commitments. As I spelled out earlier, under the Joint Plan of Action, the U.S. is committed to lift all nuclear-related sanctions. All nuclear-related sanctions. That's an amorphous term, but, presumably both parties have a sense of what that means. Mm-hmm. The best means of ensuring Iran's compliance with a deal is to ensure our own compliance with a deal. If the president were granted the power to match Iranian actions with U.S. sanctions relief, that deal becomes a strong and sustained one, which is in the interest of both parties and in the interest of, both parties creating a much different relationship than has dominated over the past 35 years. Mm. Part of this is, yes, it will start out with the president offering waivers. The president has broad authorities to offer waivers from Iran's perspective, though, there has to come a time soon after a deal is reached in which the president is granted much broader powers to terminate the sanctions.
Right.
Because from Iran's perspective, Iran's perspective is sanctions relief means that our economy opens up to the rest of the world. We want international business to come into Iran to help develop the economy. In order for that to happen, international business, international banks, et cetera, need to be reassured that the sanctions aren't going to be reimposed 6 months down the road because parties disagree over how the deal is being implemented.
That's a big part of this is the willingness of international financial institutions to participate in any kind of commerce in Iran at all because of the uncertainty. They don't know what's within the rules and what's not. They might have, like on The Simpsons, a shipment of boxes of hot pants or something, but they don't know if that's going to get their bank sanctioned right off the face of the earth by the U.S. Treasury Department because of a failure to dot an I, or even if they do dot all the correct I's. They don't know exactly what the Treasury Department's thinking about any of this at any given time, and so they just don't want to participate at all. Sorry, we can't bring you medicine because we don't want, our bank won't deal with your bank, so sorry.
Yeah, this is absolutely the case. Both parties talk about having a phased-out approach. Presumably the Iranians, the first thing on their menu will be Section 1245 of the 2012 NDAA. That is the provision that sanctions foreign financial institutions that conduct transactions with basically all of Iranian financial institutions. So it makes international trade with Iran exceptionally difficult to do because foreign financial institutions have to skirt using the Iranian financial system. The entire financial sector in Iran is a designated and is prohibited from other financial institutions engaging in business with them.
That's why they call them crippling sanctions. I mean, they really have almost on the levels of the blockade against Iraq in the 1990s. Not quite as severe, but pretty close, huh? They've tried.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a four-month waiver provision for that. I mean, that is the shortest waiver provision in all of the sanctions. It's 4 months. Every 120 days, the president would need to certify to Congress that doing so was vital to the national security interests of the United States. Now, 120 days does not provide the confidence for, you know, U.S. and foreign financial institutions to engage in the kind of transactions that Iran will expect. Right. And that presents a lot of problems to Iran, because Iran expects a benefit from this deal. And the benefit from the deal is that it is reintegrated into a global economy. If Iran doesn't see that as part of the deal, it will be very hard to ensure that their compliance with the terms of any final deal. Part of the thing that needs to happen, there needs to be some outreach to congressional allies. The White House needs to take this up as well. Right before the Vienna talks.
We got to take this break here. I'll stop you.
Okay.
The good thing is there's really no law in America. The president can do whatever he wants, so he can reassure the Iranians and show them 1,000 examples, too. Anyway, we'll be right back with Tyler Cullis from the National Iranian American Council right after this, y'all.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support The Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, guys. Welcome back. It's the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Tyler Cullis from the National Iranian American Council at niacouncil.org. Trita Parsi's outfit over there. Reza Mirashi and them. And we're talking about these sanctions and how there's so many sanctions on Iran, it's really limited Obama's ability to be able to promise the Iranians that he can lift them. And I was just going to, you know, I was kind of making a joke out of it, but it really does seem like an important point. No, that he doesn't even have to really do a waiver. All he has to do is just not enforce these sanctions and instruct the Treasury that we're not going to enforce these sanctions until I say enforce them again. And then what's Congress going to do about it? Impeach him? I mean, he changes the law with executive orders all the time. He does whatever he wants all the time. He killed Al-Awlaki's 16-year-old boy and said, yeah, so what? I mean, this guy can do whatever he wants in the world. Certainly he can make a peace deal over the objections of the Republicans in the Congress. Right?
I mean, he does have the powers to investigate, and he could choose not to investigate. I mean, recall that when the Iran Sanctions Act was first passed back in 1996, President Clinton did not enforce them. The EU actually threatened the United States with a lawsuit at the WTO, and under that deal, Clinton promised not to enforce the sanctions. And the first instance of their enforcement doesn't take place until about 2006. So it's a decade later that a provision of the Iran Sanctions Act is actually enforced. But you know, there's actually consequences to even not enforcement. The consequences were such that you can actually see foreign investment in Iran's energy sector start dwindling from 1996 on because of the expectation that at some point the sanctions could be enforced.
Yeah, the uncertainty is still there, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so the uncertainty creates a lot of problems from Iran's perspective. And that is a problem that will need resolution at some point. Maybe not before a deal, but perhaps after a deal. The White House, actually, right before the last Vienna talks, a senior administration official said that the White House is doing a lot of consultations with Congress on how to unwind the sanctions should a final deal be reached. Hopefully those consultations continue. What we would imagine is that Congress would provide the authority for the president to lift sanctions on a more permanent basis than he is presently available. That would be do the best to both secure Iran's compliance with the deal, but also to offer Iran the incentive to both make a deal with the United States on the nuclear issue and to fulfill its promise. It is very important that the United States understands that in order to inspire confidence, the confidence required for Iran to make concessions on its nuclear program, Iran has to believe that the United States can live up to its obligations under any deal reached. Mm-hmm. And right now that is unclear whether that's the case.
I actually, Tyler, just got off the phone with Barbara Slavin here, and she has this new report today for Al Jazeera, America.aljazeera.com, about a trial balloon of a possible final deal here. And part of it, of course, is, and they've been talking about this for since before the interim deal was ever signed, I think, which is that one thing that they're going to really insist on is, of course, an end to any enrichment up to 20%, and they want to see the Fordo facility, if not closed, they want to see it converted from any kind of backup enrichment facility to nothing more than, you know, kind of a highfalutin research lab or something like that, that, you know, would be taken out of the equation, in other words, for a possible breakout, that it couldn't be used for such a thing, that kind of a thing. And the way they describe it in there, you know, turning it into a research facility, that sounds like the kind of thing that's asking the Iranians to go so far on that issue that that's really not reversible or not in any, short time frame. Probably wouldn't count as reversible to them if they were to go that far. And so, you know, that was the way you phrased it before. That's how you talk about in the article. If all the sanctions relief on this side is reversible, then they'll probably only be willing to go so far in suspending or downscaling any part of their program to reversible levels themselves. And yet, anyway, the point I'm trying to make is the contrast here between what they're leaking about what it is that they want to see from the Iranians here and then what they're up against from their self-sabotage on this issue with the sanctions relief.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, the Iranian negotiators came into the deal with two principles in mind, and they communicated those two principles to U.S. negotiators. And those two principles, that whatever obligations were incurred from both parties, those obligations would be proportional and reciprocal. So if the United States made certain concessions on its nuclear program, they would be balanced out by Iranian concessions on its nuclear program. Same sanctions relief for the same concessions on nuclear program. So limited and reversible sanctions relief from Iran's perspective and from the attitude Iranian negotiators have brought to the talks will mean limited and reversible nuclear concessions as well. And that is just not going to fulfill the appetites of either hardliners in Iran or, you know, certain members of the U.S. Congress, both sides that would rather not see a deal between the United States and Iran. In order for a deal to actually take effect and take root, it needs to be strong, sustained, and secure. And the best way to do that is to put out meaningful sanctions relief so that Iran, in turn, can produce the kind of concessions on its nuclear program that are amenable to, you know, non-proliferation specialists and the like. That's the way it has to be done.
Well, as you guys put it in the article here, yeah, I mean, as far as proportional and all that, the whole idea of having the sanctions is so that you can lift them. Right? I mean, that's the whole deal, is it's a bargaining position. Unless the plan is to just reduce all Iranians to desperation for fun or whatever, right? If we're getting our cart before the horse, that kind of thing. Otherwise, the whole deal is, you know, at least the claim, and I don't really buy this, but at least their claim is this is what it takes to drive the Iranians to the table and make them deal. Well, then, okay, we got to be able to lift them on our side. Well, so I guess the question then is, how steep of a hill is this to climb in Congress? I mean, are they just, there's no way they're going to go along with this because AIPAC says so, or the president's going to be able to lead them on it and say, you know, I don't know, how much support does he have for his position, do you think?
I mean, I think there needs to be some outreach to Congress. I mean, the White House needs to do a little bit more outreach itself to Congress over, you know, where the negotiations are, you know, what the White House thinks will be needed, what authorities will need to be designated to the president should a deal be reached. You know, there needs to be that kind of consultation with Congress, so especially allies of the White House on Capitol Hill understand, you know, something is expected out of us from a final deal. You know, what is expected out of us? What is expected out of us is that the president is granted authorities to lift sanctions on a more permanent basis. You know, it's actually interesting because the report Barbara wrote about this morning actually said that, you know, as part of a final deal, Congress should pass a preemptive AUMF if Iran failed to comply with the terms of a final deal. You know, and our perspective is, you know, there's something a little almost absurd about this whole, you know, thing. You know, why is it so much easier for the president to make war rather than to make peace? You know, if members of Congress are willing to preemptively grant the president the authority to use military force, then, you know, perhaps, you know, the Congress can also grant the president the authority to make peace.
Right.
You know, to make a deal with Iran that is meaningful and sustained and, you know, it secures a new kind of basis for a relationship that has not been a good one for the past 35 years.
Yep. And you know what? Even a lame duck like Obama, and for all his troubles and all his poll number problems and whatever, when he gets up there in the State of the Union and says, hey, your sabotage Iran sanctions, your new round of sanctions that I don't want, I'll veto them, so don't even bother. All of you, back down now. They all back down, and quick. And you saw people taking their names off the co-sponsor list, and that was the end of that. He's the President of the United States. He's working on a peace deal here. Congress, get in line. He says once, and they get in line, blam, if he's willing to go that far.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the question from this White House, whether the White House is willing to reach out to members of Congress the way it needs to. It had not reached out to members of Congress during the entire run-up for the S-1881, the new sanctions legislation, and it wasn't until the State of the Union, you're totally correct, it wasn't until the State of the Union that the president in the White House decided to do some outreach on the Hill to let them know that, you know, this is hurting our negotiating position. This hurts the possibilities for us to reach a deal with Iran. And as we saw, you know, members of the president's own party quickly backed down. So there needs to be that kind of communication between the president and Congress in order to facilitate, resolution to the issue of sanctions relief.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, well, we sort of got to the Israel lobby there and the AIPAC sanctions. I saw Josh Block, who is still, unofficial spokesman for AIPAC, and he was kind of staking out some territory over on Twitter a couple of weeks back, saying that, hey, you know, they could have some form of nuclear program. Accepting a nuclear program is not the same thing as accepting enrichment. And now, of course, all the outlines of the deal that have been floated from all sides includes a recognition of their, if not their right to enrich, a recognition of the impossibility of making them stop enriching up to at least 3.6%. That's the compromise. No 20% for your medical isotopes, just 3.6% for your electricity. And the AIPAC, the Israel lobby, their position is no enrichment whatsoever. Now, I guess my question for you is, presuming that you're up there in D.C. dealing with all these politicos and stuff, is how much of a fight do you think they're willing to put up for this? Is this a real line in the sand for them, or are they kind of already resigned to the fact that this is going to happen one way or the other?
I mean, I think what's important to remember is that, you know, to some extent they're going to have to live with whatever deal is made. If it is the case that the P5+1 makes the deal with Iran, you know, the United States is put in an awful position if it chooses to renege on that deal. You know, part of the strength of the sanctions has been the political solidarity between the United States, the Europeans, Russia, and China.
Mm-hmm.
If the P5+1 is willing to enter into a deal with the Iranians, and the U.S. Congress breaks down that deal, violates the agreement, it is going to be very difficult for them to reimpose the kind of crippling sanctions that they had, because the political solidarity will no longer be there. Russia and China will certainly no longer go along with the U.S. sanctions program, and what the Europeans do then is up in the air as well.
Right. All right, well, I'm sorry we're all out of time, but thank you very much for your time on the show today. I really appreciate it, Tyler.
Thank you so much.
All right, everybody. That's Tyler Cullens. He's at the National Iranian American Council. That's NIAcouncil.org. Trita Parsi, Reza Marashi, and them over there. Tyler Cullis is his name. And the article is all over the internet, Iran's Sanctions, from March 26. We'll be right back with Gareth Porter on Manufactured Crisis right after this. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. I'm Scott Horton's show.
And no, I am not the lawyer from Harper's, although he is a heroic international anti-torture human rights lawyer whose every written word is worth your time. And who's done a lot of really great work in defending innocent torture victims and representing them on different issues and a lot of great stuff. So you should read what he writes, but you shouldn't confuse him with me. If you want to hear me interview him, well, just go to my archives. I've interviewed him 100 times. All right, good. All right, so next up on the show today is Gareth Porter. This will be, I think it's part 10 now, Gareth, of our continuing series, and this won't be the last one. I think there'll be one more after this, on your brand new book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Again, that's Gareth Porter, Just World Books, and you can find it at Amazon.com and all over the place, Manufactured Crisis. And, you know, thank you. This is kind of ridiculous. You giving me so much time and going over chapter by chapter by chapter through your book with me here on the show, Gareth. But I sure do appreciate all your journalism, and I love this book. You've done such a good job on it, and I'm interested in every little part of it. So I sure do appreciate you giving us so much time to go over with us here.
I'm happy to have the opportunity to talk about the book, and indeed, I think this is an unprecedented series of interviews on a single book, but I'm flattered, of course, and glad that you're so interested, and I hope that your listeners are getting enough information to make them want to come back for more.
Yeah, I think so. Man, pardon me. I've gotten some pretty good comments by way of Twitter and whatever saying, man, you ought to combine all these interviews into one big sort of audiobook kind of a format for us, and this kind of thing, which I guess I will end up doing. Anyway, some people like it, and that's good enough for me. Chapter whatever it is, I guess 11, is the fake war crisis. And now, in a way, you made me feel like an idiot when I read this, because what you said was they never really were going to have a war, more or less. I'm overly simplifying, but...
No, not at all.
So all your worry about that they were ever going to have a war, nah, pretty much they were just psyching you out. My only saving grace is that I think I kind of knew that they were just psyching me out all along anyway and playing good cop, bad cop anyway, but I figured I had to do my best to debunk their bogus case anyway, just in case. And so they were only kind of half-using me to drum up the fear that they were trying to drum up.
Well, Scott, if you had an inkling that that this was a fake as long ago as 2008, for example, then you were ahead of me, because I fell for it completely. I admit it quite freely that in 2008 I did, in fact, believe that Israel was that there was a serious risk, serious danger that Israel was going to attack Iran, and this was all very carefully laid out. A New York Times article talking about a major Israeli Air Force exercise that was simulating essentially what they would have to do in order to attack Iran and bomb the nuclear sites, and sort of ending with the New York Times piece with a, I don't know if it ended, but included in the piece was a statement essentially quoting Pentagon officials, unnamed Pentagon officials, saying that indeed, this was a preparation for a possible Israeli attack. Very unusual, because here you've got U.S. Pentagon officials essentially becoming spokesmen for the Israeli government or the Israeli military. I can't think of anything like that in my memory, at least. And it certainly lent a degree of urgency, in my view. But since then, I have learned, and I document this in the book, that this was all part of a very clever ruse to frighten the world and to get people to do the bidding of the Israeli government, which means to get them to take very harsh measures toward Iran. And,
all right, now hold on a second. You can prove that to me here in a minute. But first of all, let's talk about some reasons to believe that maybe there really could have been a war at this time or the other. And this is something that I guess you don't seem to bring up in the chapter, I don't think, is the possibility, as it was discussed then, you know, 07, 08, whenever, that the Israelis would go ahead and start the war and drag America into it. In fact, when the State Department cables were first finally leaked, that was Larissa, the wife's first story out of there, was here was Mayor Dagan when he was the head of
Mossad meeting with Nicholas Burns, the American ambassador to whatever at the time. I don't know if he was the ambassador to Israel at the time or what. But anyway,
yes,
meeting with him.
And the Secretary for Middle East.
Yeah, and so meeting with him and basically saying, well, hey, wouldn't you prefer to start the war on your terms and do it your way and make sure you win rather than have us drag you into this damn thing, which seemed to be a not very subtle threat that we're willing to do that. And, of course, Hirsch talked about, Cheney was willing to have a false flag attack of, special forces attack the regular Navy and the, dress up somebody and fake an attack in the Persian Gulf. And what was the other one I was just thinking of a second ago, too? The threat of strikes over the pretension that Iran was behind all of our problems in Iraq in the spring of 2007.
I do talk about that.
Oh, and David Wurmser, that Stephen Clemens leak of David Wurmser going around and saying that Cheney was insubordinate, and Cheney was considering, had already even talked to Ehud Olmert about the possibility that they would get Israel to strike and they would drag Bush kicking and screaming into the thing because Cheney had lost confidence that Bush was going to do the right thing and start this damn war. And so now what about all of that all at once?
Well, I mean, first of all, I do mention the fact that Cheney did indeed propose within the Bush administration in 2007, according to multiple sources, including one who talked to me on the record, which I wrote about in 2008, that Cheney was proposing a policy to carry out a retaliatory strike against an incident that was that they expected might happen in Iraq, where U.S. troops were killed, that could be blamed on the Iranians through the usual magic of propaganda, and that was, of course, quickly sat on by the Pentagon, the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They essentially bottled it up, and it never went anywhere because of the multiple reasons why the war system in this country, except for the neocons, really had no taste for a war against Iran, because it would have cost the United States dearly in terms of its bases and particularly naval ships, and because of the extreme danger that it would really send the global economy into a tailspin, because it would result in stopping oil passing through the Gulf of the Strait of Hormuz for some significant period of time.
Right. Well, for the record, just in case anybody was at risk of getting it wrong or anything about how wrong you're admitting to being about this at any given time, the first time I ever interviewed you was at the height of the danger, really, if there ever was one, was January of 07 when Bush was disregarding the James Baker report and instead was going with fat-neck Fred Kagan and General Petraeus on the surge into Iraq, and a huge part of half or more of his speech announcing it in January of 07 was, and by the way, the only reason we're having any problems over there is because Iran is supplying weapons to the bad guys, which was ridiculous because that was the same side America was fighting on. But anyway, my first interview of you, you had written a thing that was reprinted from IPS at antiwar.com about how, nah, all this hype is just for the rubes, because Condoleezza Rice gave this small private briefing to a few State Department reporters that got on the back page that said, nah, don't worry about it. If anything, we're maybe going to bomb them this summer, but definitely not right now. So very careful in parsing and being skeptical about what they were bragging and what they were saying to Fox News, I think, as you put it at the time, and what they were, telling people who really mattered.
Well, it's true that in an earlier period, in 2005, 2006, 2007, I was very cautious about some of the reports that were talking about a strike by the United States against Iran. I think there were multiple reasons. I thought there were multiple reasons for doubting that that was the case at that point, and obviously I was right about that. But I'm referring specifically to the way in which the Israelis cleverly got the story out in 2008. I did fall for that one. It was not really until 2011 that I really caught on, or 2012. I'm sorry, it was early 2012 that I caught on that there was this long-term Israeli policy of using the threat of an attack for their political diplomatic purposes, and that it had been very successful, and that it was now you know, I saw through it at the point where I realized that there was a good cop, bad cop routine being played between the Obama administration and Israel over this. So all that came together in my mind in the spring, in the late winter and early spring of 2012.
And so, really, this is all just basically Netanyahu. I guess Obama's playing the straight man to Netanyahu, and he's Kissinger, and Netanyahu is Nixon, going, tell him I'm drunk and angry and crazy, Henry, but it's all just, you know, a joke. I mean, he is drunk,
that's true,
but it's still just a joke.
Except for one thing, and that is that it actually started before Netanyahu. As I point out in the chapter on the phony war crises, the first phony war crisis was actually that 2008 one, and that was actually Ehud Olmert's government. But the key figure in that, of course, was Defense Minister Ehud Barak. Mm-hmm. He was the one who masterminded the fake crisis, the fake threat of a war against Iran, and of course he then became Defense Minister under Bibi Netanyahu's government. So there was continuity there. It was a combination of Netanyahu and Barak. But in a sense, you have to say that Barak was the more important figure because he'd already been through this. He'd already started the ruse. He knew the ins and outs of it. And in fact, whenever you saw a background interviews, unnamed high-level official in Israel talking about this subject, you know that it was Ehud Barak. I mean, Netanyahu wasn't smart enough to be able to bring that off. And so he always depended on Barak to do those interviews.
Well, one interesting footnote here to me is that in 2010, when Netanyahu and Barak both talked to Jeffrey Goldberg at The Atlantic, and this was the whole if you don't do it, I will kind of thing, one of the versions of it anyway. But both of them in that interview admitted that their version of what amounted to an existential threat was a joke, that young, talented Israelis would go to grad school in America and stay there, and that would amount to some fatal brain drain. And then the other one was, well, geez, if Iran had nukes, no, it's not like we fear a nuke strike. That's just what we tell the idiot American Republican voters, that we fear a first strike because of the 12th Imam and all this crap. We're just worried that it would give Hezbollah a little bit more freedom of action. And it would, in other words, it would limit their ability to do whatever they want to whoever they want with no accountability whatsoever in the Middle East. That's not an existential threat.
That's precisely right. And what is
they
so...
kind of tip their hand there.
Okay, I'll wait until we come back from the break.
Damn break. I'm sorry, I walked all over your punchline there, Garrett. God dang it. I suck at this. One second, y'all. We'll be right back with Garrett Porter in just a moment. Manufactured Crisis is the book. Go buy it. See, you had time. You could have said it. Too late now. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show, and I'm talking with Gareth Porter, author of Manufactured Crisis, about the fake Iran nuclear weapons threat. And I'm sorry there, Gareth, about the hard break there, interrupting. When we were going out to break, we were talking about how they admitted back in 2010, Barak and Netanyahu both, that they ain't scared of Iran. And they know that even if Iran did have a nuke or two or ten, what are they going to do? Nothing. And so then you were going to say...
Yeah, and I was just about to say that this is so typical of this whole genre of Israeli propaganda threats and other types of other elements of the Israeli propaganda mechanism with regard to Iran, that so much of it is so threadbare, it's really quite easy to see through, in part because there's so much that people like Ehud Barak and people other people in the government and people in the Israeli media say that give it away. And so my book is really sprinkled, this chapter particularly, is sprinkled with giveaways that you can get from just following the Israeli press and the statements made by people like Ehud Barak. I mean, Barak himself, in an interview at one point, at this moment I've forgotten which year it was, but it doesn't matter, basically said, you know, that he would not say that Iran had a nuclear program because it was targeting Israel. That, in fact, you know, Israel was probably not the main reason for Iran to think about nuclear weapons. So, I mean, you know, there's a kind of casualness about the Israeli propaganda that is quite interesting. And, to my mind, it bespeaks a degree of overconfidence and sort of, braggadocio that should make it easy to penetrate. But I must say that they've gotten away with this scot-free despite that.
All right. Now, I really want you to just have enough time to go over your version of the history of Obama's so-called diplomacy on this issue.
Yes.
It's unique and it's important, but I wonder if you can tell me when it is that they, or the Bush administration before them, finally just gave up on the possibility of regime change there, or have they given it up? They just don't know how to get it yet, or they can't have a war, they know, but they still want to do a color revolution, or what's the deal?
It's a very good question, Scott, and I don't have the inside dope on precisely the answer to that, but what we do know is that on one hand, the neocons pushed regime change as the official policy option for the Bush administration very, very hard, beginning in 2003, but that was never accepted officially by the Bush administration. George W. Bush, perhaps because he listened to Colin Powell, maybe he had somebody else that he spoke with as well, but he never officially agreed to that, and that was a major frustration for the neocons in the Bush administration. At the same time, even after, I shouldn't say even after, maybe especially after Condoleezza Rice became the Secretary of State in 2005, you know, she continued to hint that regime change was somehow the policy without ever coming out and saying it. So there is this funny aspect of the Bush administration that, despite the fact that there was never a clear-cut decision when the neocons had their strongest basis in the Bush administration, that you still have a lot of talk that flirted with the idea of regime change after 2004. And I think that you know, it was still being discussed. It was still kind of in the background, either as an unofficial policy line without ever having been officially embraced, as far as we know, until the end of the Bush administration. And when the Obama administration came in, and I would just add one more thing, and that is that what I think is the key turning point there is that the neoconservatives began to lose hope in regime change sufficiently by the end of 2005, that was the signal for people like Reuel, Mark Jarecht, and the other sort of amen chorus people outside the government in the Israeli propaganda chorus to start calling explicitly for bombing Iran. And so that's really the dead giveaway that there had been a loss of real optimism, and you know, they basically decided, well, we're not going to be able to accomplish this, so we have to turn to trying to raise the flag of attacking Iran, regardless of the regime change issue. And when Obama came in, I don't know of any evidence that the policy was based on the hope for regime change. I think in 2009, when the major protest took place in Iran over the election of June 2009, that there certainly was some conversation within the administration over, you know, whether this would affect U.S. policy and whether we should whether this administration should base its policy in part on the calculation that maybe there could be very serious pressure on the government. I think there was a discussion of that, but it never resulted in a decision to go for regime change. So as far as I know, that has not been a serious part of the policy since the Obama administration came in.
All right, and then so what has been the policy? Because it came in talking all this about how, hey, I recognize you're the Islamic Republic of Iran, first time an American president ever called them that, and said, hey, let's make peace, and kind of talked about, you know, we could do this kind of swap deal. But by the fall of 2009, his first year in power, it was so obvious, especially with the big fake outing of the comm facility there. At the end of October, beginning of November 2009, that and the Jandala attacks inside Iran as well at the same time, that really they were just kind of waiting out the self-imposed deadline of New Year's 2009 to say that the Iranians aren't coming to heel, and now we got to go the route of sanctions.
Well, I think that, in fact, the decision was already made well before that. I think it was made early in the Obama administration, that they would go through with going through the motions of negotiating with Iran, but that the real policy was going to be sanctions, a serious effort at sanctions that would be used to pressure Iran to agree to come to heel with regard to their nuclear program. And exactly how much they expected to get realistically from Iran is not clear. You know, were they?
Say Obama actually asked the Brazilians and the Turks to please do this for him and follow up on the second nuke swap deal at the end of 2009, beginning of 2010, right?
Yes, that's right. They did do that, and that seems to be at odds. I mean, there's a contradiction there, in a sense, between encouraging them to talk to the Iranians about the swap deal and the emphasis that I'm talking about with regard to going ahead with a much tougher set of sanctions. And I happen to think that there was a kind of screw-up in the administration, that there was never any real intention to get a deal. I think that they were encouraging, the White House was encouraging Brazil and Turkey to do that without expecting that it was going to result in the Iranians agreeing. I think what they thought was that the Turks and the Brazilians would try to get the Iranians on board, and the Iranians would say no, and then the United States could cite that in support of its effort to get organize sanctions. So, I mean, they miscalculated, and then they had to do a quick switch in signals, which of course they did without even blinking an eye.
Yeah, wasn't that hard. And then you say in there that actually, you get into the story of Mayor Dagan later complained about publicly about Netanyahu trying to raise the alert level inside Israel, and it was the day that it came out that the Brazilians and the Turks had worked out a nuclear swap.
Yeah. This is, I think, one of the most fascinating episodes in this whole story about the Israeli sort of phony war crises. It was indeed in 2010. I believe it was April, forgotten the exact date, April 8th or April 10th, something like that, 2010, when I think Netanyahu and his advisors really did believe that the United States was going to turn tail and in fact make a deal with Iran based on the agreement, the tripartite agreement between Brazil, Turkey, and Iran. And so they were quite desperate to do something to head this off. And what they did was Netanyahu and Barak came up, I'm sure it was Barak, his idea, because he was the one who knows how to manipulate the military in order to make political points. The idea was that they would put the IDF on the highest state of alert, really a state of alert that is a prelude to war, in order to frighten the United States and other countries into backing off what they were afraid would be, moving towards a diplomatic agreement with Iran. And the result of that was that it was brought up at a meeting of the inner cabinet, the security cabinet of the Netanyahu government, which of course meant the head of the IDF, Gabi Ashkenazi, and Meir Dagan, the head of Mossad, were there. And in fact, the way the story was presented, the account that was presented in a television program a couple years later, what happened was that at the end of the meeting, and apparently they had discussed various ways in which to respond, but as Ashkenazi and Dagan were leaving the meeting, Netanyahu sort of casually says, I want you to put the IDF on this highest state of alert. And Meir Dagan basically denounced this as illegal and refused to have anything to do with it. And apparently Ashkenazi was ready to go along with that. And so basically Netanyahu backed down from this. And the fallout of it, you know, the major significance of this politically is that it was after that that Meir Dagan had it in for the Prime Minister Netanyahu, and after he was essentially fired by Netanyahu, he came out publicly calling Netanyahu irresponsible and unworthy of being of leadership of Israel, and it was apparently because of his having been so irresponsible. I mean, and what Dagan was arguing quite I think reasonably is that it was not that they intended to actually go to war. He didn't believe they intended to go to war against Iran. But, you know, obviously the Iranians would see this, and there was a danger that this could somehow provoke a warlike atmosphere that could be very dangerous, that it could be a tit-for-tat kind of situation. And so he after that, he came out against publicly against the Netanyahu government's policy towards Iran, and that really sort of opened up a new debate within Israel, which had not been taking place up to that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, then again, at least from their point of view, all this worked, right? All this good cop, bad cop, whatever. They got their crippling sanctions. They got Russia. Did Russia and China and the rest, the European members of the Security Council, they all bought into this bluff. Everybody bought into this bluff, and that's why they did what they did. Why else would they have got in on the sanctions? But
well, you know,
then
Scott,
again, I can't believe that they're that much of fools either, right? I don't know.
I honestly don't know the answer to that. I don't have sources within any of those governments. I have not talked to anybody who really claims to know. And, I mean, you know, so my answer has to be that I simply don't know to what extent there were suspicions of the Israeli claim, you know, the propaganda ruse of threatening war against Iran. I suspect that certainly there were people within all those governments who had suspicions, and I'm quite sure, as I argue in the book, that the Obama administration didn't really believe it. I mean, there's multiple episodes where, you know, there are giveaways that Obama administration officials knew perfectly well that there was no plan to attack Iran, and I talk about the case of the, I guess it was, let's see, the early spring, late winter of 2012, when the then Secretary of Defense of the Obama administration, what's his name? Forgotten his name all of a sudden. The guy who was the former chief of staff at the White House, he comes out and says, you know, well, I'm really worried that Israel may want to attack Iran in the late spring, early summer of this year. And, I mean, that was so clearly out of line with what they knew perfectly well, that Israel had no plans to do that, that I think it gave away the whole game about the Obama administration's role in this.
Bad acting on their part.
It was bad acting. It was not even minimally credible. But again, I mean, the news media acted like, oh yeah, this is the real thing. I mean, no one questioned this, as far as I can see. I didn't see any evidence of it.
All right. And then, so I guess, is it right then that right around the time that Meir Dagan was over it, that Obama's over it too, that he's done playing good cop here, he's used Netanyahu for his purposes, and never mind Netanyahu's purposes, he's used Netanyahu as bad cop enough, and he's created the sanctions regime that apparently he wanted to enough to go ahead and move the deal forward in a way that Netanyahu objects to, which is, you know, an attempt to actually make a deal here?
Yeah, I mean, it's very clear that Obama's plan all along in 2011, 2012 was that they would exploit the threat of the alleged threat of an Israeli attack on Iran to put pressure diplomatically on Iran. They wanted to have the sanctions start taking hold in 2012, and then they would bring Iran to the negotiating table, and there was this sense of, well, we really got them where we want them right now, because they felt the sanctions were going to be so devastating. And so this was all tied up with the idea of getting really decisive leverage over the Iranians for the first time. And this is kind of a, to me, it's a perfect illustration of the danger of, you know, American military dominance, you know, the dominant military power in the world dealing with a small power that's not even, you know, a tiny fraction of the military power of the United States, and the sense of false confidence that gives I think every single U.S. administration in its policymaking with regard to an adversary. And I think this is a perfect illustration of how that leads policy toward to go astray. And, you know, this Obama administration is certainly one of the worst in that regard.
Well, you know, previously on the show today, I talked with Barbara Slavin about a trial balloon of the American position of what all concessions they want out of the Iranians, which she noted seemed to exclude kind of any summary of how much they'd be willing to give up in terms of sanctions relief. And then I talked with a guy named Tyler Cullis from the National Iranian Council about those sanctions and how difficult it'll be, could be, for Obama to be able to promise the Iranians anything more than temporary waiver relief, and therefore he'll only be able to get so much concessions from them in any kind of final deal. And so, kind of in other words, it's sort of like calling Saddam Hussein Hitler for all those years. Well, now you can't ever negotiate with him again. Now you got to do something because he's Hitler. You can't negotiate with Hitler, that kind of thing. Well, now they've built up this manufactured crisis to such a big deal, and they've got so many layers of crippling sanctions, as they call them, that they've kind of put themselves in the position where they can't really back down, not in a way that is very obvious or easy to satisfy all sides in any meaningful kind of way. For example, one specific example would be the level of change, I guess. I don't know what's called the change at Fordo that they want. They want to turn right. Fordo from a real centrifuge facility into just a research facility right. kind of thing. In other words, a large permanent change in what's going on there. So that's not the kind of temporary, you know, tit for tat kind of change that you can negotiate in exchange for a temporary 6-month waiver that may or may not last after Jeb comes. You know.
Well, I think, you know, standing aside for the moment, I mean, setting aside for the moment the specifics of negotiating positions the United States is now taking toward various technical questions on the table in these negotiations, which, you know, in my view, it's going to be very difficult to predict at this moment just how far the United States will backtrack from its opening gambits in those negotiations. I think the bigger question is one that you did, in fact, just allude to a moment ago, and that is just how far the administration has gone in confirming and repeating and committing itself to this whole narrative of Iran as nuclear threat, as committed to wanting to get nuclear weapons, and therefore, you know, having to be forced into abandoning them. All that is so, you know, one layer after another has been built up after so many years that I do believe, in fact, that it is extremely difficult to turn that propaganda ship, as it were, around. And I think that's very worrisome. I'm not saying it's impossible. I mean, of course, I think it is possible to do so. But, you know, does this administration have the wherewithal in terms of its intelligence, of its understanding, its consciousness to do it? I don't know. I have my doubts.
Yeah, well, It's John Kerry and them over there. Although, did you see the Phil? And I'm sorry because I've kept you over time here, but it seems like we're more or less wrapping up the book here, Gareth. So I just
wanted to see
if we can wrap it up. Phil Giraldi had a report in the American Conservative a few weeks back. He's a source that you cite in here, former CIA officer. I know you know him well, friend of the show here, of course. And he said that whoever his sources were said that the CIA was there when they were having the secret kind of backroom talks in Oman with the Iranians, you know, that was taking place behind the scenes while John Kerry's doing the dance for the cameras and all of that, and that they pretty much worked it out. And the CIA analysts were there, and they figured out, well, here's how much we're willing to give, and we figure if you're only enriching this many centrifuges up to this many percent, then it'll take that long for you to do that much better than that and threaten us with a nuclear bomb, and so, et cetera, et cetera. They worked out the actual calculus, not the horrible figure of speech that people use nowadays, but they worked out the algorithm for what they're willing to tolerate for an existing verified and safeguarded nuclear program inside Iran, and that they pretty much already reached a deal, and now it's just up to the politicians to shut each other up enough to shake hands over the deal. So what about that?
Well, it's possible. I don't know. I mean, you know, it's not a story that I'm familiar with that is specifically that incident that Phil's describing about sort of reaching an agreement well before the talks took place in October, which I assume is what you're referring to, and maybe that's true. I would be surprised that they were able to go that far. Certainly, everything that I have picked up over the last few months suggests that it's not a done deal. That's far from saying that it's not possible to reach a deal. Simply that you know, the two sides are have negotiating positions which are still far apart, but you know, I mean, maybe so, maybe they have in fact gone much farther than either side is willing to indicate, and that they're playing this in a way that is extremely clever, far more clever than I'm giving them credit for, and if that's the case, then you know, I mean, we'll be much better off than what I'm suggesting, you know, is my fear of how things are playing out at this point. I mean, my sense is that there's still a great deal of uncertainty on the part of the Obama administration about how to, you know, how to play this, how far they're willing to go, how far they can go towards compromise with Iran. I mean, I think everybody knows that there has to be some degree of compromise, but that leaves a great deal still left unsettled, in my mind at least.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it would just be a tragedy if they couldn't work out the final details after bringing it this far, which is pretty damn far with
well,
the interim deal
and true.
Being
and
implemented.
I would also add, Scott, that I just wrote a piece published today at IPS in which I actually changed my view on one issue which I was very concerned about, and I thought it was a potential deal breaker, that is the quote possible military dimensions unquote issue. That is the allusion to the all this tainted intelligence, what I call the tainted intelligence underlying the manufactured crisis. The two big sets of documents, one being the alleged studies or laptop documents, the laptop of death, quote unquote. And the other one being all those documents the Israelis turned over to the IAEA directly, 2002-08, 2009, which then came out in the 2011 IAEA report. So what I've now concluded, based on a careful review of what has been said publicly by the Israeli chorus in the United States, the people at WinUp and the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, etc., and what has been said by U.S. officials on the same subject, is that the Israelis were quite upset that the U.S. government did not respond to their pressure to demand that Iran actually make a confession that it had had a covert nuclear weapons program in the past, and in fact that the Obama administration steered clear of that pitfall, that what would have been, I think, a deal breaker had they gone along with it, and they instead put forward language which they could cite that would not require essentially anything different from the Iranians. I think that they intend, I now believe that they intend to finesse that in some way through the IAEA, and that the deal probably can be made. I think the IAEA agreement with Iran to discuss the exploding bridge wire issue, that is the studies that were done, the experiments that were done allegedly by Iran using exploding bridge wire technology to set up a system for detonating nuclear weapons, that was a sign that perhaps they can settle this based on simply the acceptance of what the Iranians have said all along, that this was not for a nuclear application. It was for a non-nuclear application, and they've been able to document that. So I have some greater hope that that's now, you know, not going to be an issue that's going to cause the collapse of the talks. So at least that's eliminated one thing, but I think that there's still some very formidable issues still to be worked out.
Well, you know, I sure want to be optimistic about this, if only because I'm so sick and tired of this manufactured crisis. It's so obviously a fake crisis. And to have this level of Cold War still after, you know, basically my whole lifetime, pretty much, Gareth, a Cold War with Iran, where the biggest excuse and really the last excuse that they can come up with, because nobody cares about the hostages anymore. I mean, come on. That was 1979. The excuse that they have is this nuclear program, and oh my God, they're going to make nukes and they're going to kill all the Israelis with them, and et cetera. And it seems like if, in fact, the American establishment, and with or without Obama leading them, I don't know whose idea it is to really push this thing or what, but it seems like some major part of the American establishment has decided they really do want to pursue this thing. And it seems like if the biggest outstanding issue is a big fake manufactured crisis over their nuclear program that's always been safeguarded and verified after all, and that all they have to do is extra super verify it and open up to some further inspections and even more cameras and whatever kind of things, that how could they not work it out if they really want to work it out now? You know, congressional sanctions be damned. They do whatever they want to make sure and get this thing implemented if that's what they want to do, right?
Well, of course, the main myth at this point that could block an agreement is this business of breakout. I mean, you know, I don't want to get in detail about this, but, you know, this whole notion that you have to have at least 6 months during which the United States would have the time, the leisure to sort of talk things over with its allies and friends and figure out, well, who's going to get on board to attack Iran? How are we going to do this? You know, what's going to be the sequence of events and work out the choreography? All of that stuff requires 6 months or more for the United States after the Iranians have given this mythical signal that they're now going to try to break out and get a nuclear weapon. I mean, that's all. I mean, anybody who is really, truly independent of the politics of this thing knows that that is ridiculous. It has nothing to do with reality. It's simply a kind of symbolic, you know, sort of victory for the United States. Nothing more than that. It has no technical significance whatsoever. It's all political. And so, you know, we have to see if the Obama administration has the political will to withstand what is this huge pressure coming from the pro-Israeli right and the fellow travelers and the people in between, the arms controllers who, you know, are somehow caught in between the two sides, and the news media. I mean, the news media is so horrible about this. They don't have the slightest clue about reality, and they are constantly reporting the pro-Israeli viewpoint as though it's somehow an objective impartial, non-political, technical approach to this problem. And so, you know, all of this adds up to a huge dead weight hanging, you know, sort of, you know, I should say, you know, bringing the level of the discourse down to the point where it makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah, well, that's for sure. I mean, again, so that ought to make it easy for them to go ahead and get with reality and face down any, you know, nonsense-based argument to the contrary, but I guess
agreed.
We'll have to see.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it should be easy to do, but, I mean, you know, it's, the history of this administration is such that that they have not shown themselves normally to have the will and the wit to do that very well. So, you know, I just think it's hanging in the balance at this moment, is my sense.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time on the show today and for your work on this book and all your time on the show that you've given us, Gareth. I sure appreciate it.
Thanks so much for giving me all this time. I really appreciate that very much, Scott.
All right, everybody. That's Gareth Porter. The book is Manufactured Crisis. Hey, help support, huh? Manufactured Crisis is on sale down the street at your bookstore and Amazon.com and everywhere else. It's published by Just World Books. Manufactured Crisis, the Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare by Dr. Gareth Porter.